here we are, the third Sunday in Lent, nearly halfway through Lent. I'm sorry I missed out on the start of the season, the Ash Wednesday service that you held here, not least because I wanted to tell you an Ash Wednesday quip that my sister sent to me. This is it. They say we all come from dust, and we will go to dust. And that's why I never dust. It might be someone I know. Of course, Lent isn't a time for jokes. It's a very, very serious season, a solemn season. If we were in an Anglican church today, there wouldn't be any flowers, and there wouldn't be any music after the service. It's a solemn time, and it will get more so, particularly during Holy Week, where we'll see Jesus confronted by people who hate him, who want to kill him, and we'll be with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, as he pleads with God to let this cup pass from him. We'll be with him as he's arrested and his friends run away, and we'll see him mocked, humiliated, beaten, and nailed to a cross. And we'll hear him cry out to God, "Why have you forsaken me?" It's a hugely sorrowful season. Some years ago, when we were visiting my niece and her family around this time of year, we'd been to church with them and were chatting to the children about their Sunday school, and we were sitting down to lunch, and as we tucked into lunch, the youngest one got very thoughtful and started playing with the food on her plate, and after a few minutes she looked up and her eyes were full of tears, and she said, "They killed him. They killed Jesus, and he never did anything wrong. He was only doing what his father had told him." She'd been thinking about what she'd learned in Sunday school, and she found Jesus' sorrow and suffering and the injustice of it all absolutely overwhelming. Good Friday is an epitome of human suffering, such sorrow, such injustice. Human suffering and sorrow and injustice, well, they've troubled us forever, and we ask why. Why do we suffer? Well, I want to try to unpack this a bit today. This is probably the thorniest of all issues that face us human beings. And I want to unpack it because I believe there's a powerful Christian response to be made to human suffering. And if we fail to make that response, we fail God and the whole Christian enterprise. And it's contained partly in that little story of the woman who anointed Jesus, and partly in our verses from St. Paul, which are so important. I like them so much, I've made up some actions to them. So if you want to do actions to it, it goes like this. Suffering produces endurance. Endurance produces character. And character produces hope. If you want to do it with me, Katie wants to do it with me. Suffering produces endurance. Endurance produces character. And character produces hope. Excellent, excellent. Well, as we think about this issue, I've turned to a little book which I've used before and I like it very much. It's called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It's an old book written in the 1980s, but it's still in print. You can get a copy off the internet if you want to read it for yourself. It's by Harold Kushner, who was a rabbi, and his son was born with an incurable condition and died in his early teens. And the question that posed for him were the questions that have tormented humanity since the dawn of time. Why? Why him, this innocent little boy? And why our family? And why didn't God stop this from happening? And these were questions that the rabbi was meeting constantly in his ministry, as any minister does, as he tried to support members of his congregation, people who'd suffered all sorts of things. Illness, accidents, deaths, failures, tragedies of many types. It sounds like a miserable book, but it's not. He writes with quite a wit. Jewish humor, as we know, is really quite dry and quite very amusing. Remember Lionel Blue, who was on Radio 4's Thought for the Day? He told lots of little jokes, and here's a little Jewish joke for you. Mrs. Cohen is walking down the street when she meets a friend, and the friend says, "Mrs. Cohen, you look terrible. What's the matter?" Mrs. Cohen says, "It's my husband. He's ill again." And the friend says, "Oh dear, He's just a hypochondriac. He only thinks he's ill. Well, the friends part, and a few weeks later they meet up again, and Mrs. Cohen looks even worse. "Is your husband any better?" the friend asks. Mrs. Cohen replies, "No, he's worse. Now he thinks he's dead." Anyway, this book first goes through the ways the religious people try to explain suffering. God is our loving parent, all-powerful, so he wouldn't allow bad things to happen unless there's a good reason. That's where some of these thoughts begin. So the first reason people come up with is that God must be punishing us. And the Old Testament is full of suggestions that God will punish the bad people and the good people will thrive. So all we have to do is be good and everything will be fine. But of course, we know in practice this isn't true. What did the rabbi's infant son do to deserve to be punished with an incurable disease? What did his family do to deserve the sorrow they had to endure? That bad things happen to us, our punishments, is a thought that defies logic, as bad things do happen to good people. So our sufferings are not punishment from God. When someone asks, "What did I do to deserve this?" the answer is nothing. Another way people try to explain suffering is to suggest that God has a reason for our suffering, as part of a larger plan that we might not understand now, but will one day. My sister believes this. And when her brother-in-law died a very painful, premature death, that was what she was proposing to say to his devastated widow. And then she was going to follow it with another common reflection about suffering, that she would cope because God never sends us more than we can bear. Well, I persuaded her not to say either one of those things, because not only are they not true, but they would have been no comfort to her sister-in-law. The idea that God has his reasons to impose suffering upon us, which are part of a larger plan which you don't understand, and so we just have to suck it up, that makes a monster out of God. And we all know people who do not cope with their suffering, people who collapse under its weight. So God does not send suffering as part of some larger plan that we cannot fathom. And the final explanation for suffering we fall back on is that God has sent us our sufferings to teach us a lesson. And we do learn from our suffering, as St. Paul reminds us today. In fact, I reckon we learn more from our mistakes, from the hard times we live through, than from the things that go right, the easy times. For example, I've probably preached 1,000 sermons over my times, but I've forgotten 999 of them. The one I remember is the one I fluffed. It was at a great big circuit service, and I utterly blew it, stumbled over my words, got ideas back to front, misquoted scripture, a humiliating disaster. And I did because I hadn't prepared adequately. So I learned, and now I write down every word. It's all written here. I can still make a huge mistake, and I probably will today, but I try not to. A humiliating mistake taught me a lesson, but God didn't make me fluff the sermon. In fact, I think he would have preferred it if I hadn't. God can help us learn from suffering, but he does not engineer mistakes and accidents and suffering so that we will. All these reasons we come up with to explain our suffering, to explain why bad things happen to good people, are very unhelpful. And they make our loving God into a monster. The 16th century mystic Teresa of Avila once quipped, if this is how you treat your friends, no wonder you have so few. So Kushner suggests the problem is in us. We misunderstand God. God is omnipotent, but he's defined his power, and it's not what we think. Before God can do anything for us and around us, he has to operate by the way he shaped creation and by the way he has shaped us. He has written laws for nature and has given us free will. And he cannot interrupt these basic features of existence without causing the whole show to collapse. For example, the law of gravity means he cannot keep a child from falling from a window or keep an airplane in the sky when its engine fails. And human free will means God cannot stay the hand of a murderer or get a drunk driver behind the wheel of a car. God is omnipotent, but has defined his power. But when we look at the cauldron of human suffering, we can see that God is not absent from our suffering, and he does have an answer to it. To help us understand where he is in our suffering, God did an amazing thing. He sent himself to live alongside us. He sent Jesus, whom we call Emmanuel, God with us. The incarnation is the answer to where God is in our suffering. He is with us. In a few weeks, we're going to see our Emmanuel experience some of the worst things that can happen to a human. But God's final answer is the resurrection. Suffering and pain do not have the last word. And this resurrection not only resolves Jesus' suffering, but it sets his spirit free to be with us and in us, so we can be alongside one another, carrying one another's burdens, easing one another's suffering. And of course, this is where God was even before Jesus. Rabbi Kushner obviously doesn't believe any of the things about Jesus that we believe, but he does reach this same conclusion. And he does because God is working through so many people to alleviate suffering. He notes how often insurance companies call things like floods or hurricanes or strikes of lightning, calls them acts of God. And he says, that's rubbish. The acts of God are the people who come to help the victims, the people who donate money to support the victims, the people who pray for the victims. People, he says, are the language of God. And this is what Jesus thinks too, when he tells us that the compassionate action of a nameless woman who anoints him must be proclaimed far and wide as good news of the kingdom. He's telling us this very thing. She is the language of God. And this is where God is in our suffering, alongside us, comforting and strengthening us. And though it's usually through people, sometimes we may even experience what seems to be the glorious presence of God himself. Here's a story about that from our good friend Robin Dowsett. Some of you might remember him. He was Nick's late partner. And he would often tell a story of his experience of God. It was during the Blitz when he was a small boy, sheltering with his mother from the bombing in a cupboard under the stairs. And while there, he felt a strong presence in that cupboard that filled him with peace and confidence and took away all his fear. And that awareness stayed with him his whole life. And I remember him as a man of enormous faith. My mother had a similar story when she was in hospital following the accident I told you about in the newsletter. She was in hospital late one night and all was quiet. And she was lying awake, and suddenly she became aware of a presence filling the room. And she felt a warm hand on her head, one of the few parts of her body that still had feeling. And it filled her with peace, and it filled her with hope, and it never left her. Such stories are unusual, but very precious and life-changing. But since we are usually the way people experience the presence of God, the question to ask in our suffering is not, why has this happened to me? But rather, what is my response to it? And here is where our verses from St. Paul come in. Suffering produces endurance. Endurance produces character. Character produces hope. Hope is arguably the most important ingredient in our lives, because hope is the driver of any attempt to cope with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. If you lose hope, you lose everything. Dr. Martin Luther King once said, we must accept finite disappointment, but we must never lose infinite hope. His great successor put it in another way. And remember, he was a great fiery preacher, so I'll try to say it like he did. He said, hold your head up high, stick your chest out, You can make it. It gets dark sometimes, but morning comes. Keep hope alive. Great. Keep hope alive. And our hope, my friends, isn't just any old hope. As we sang in our opening hymn, all our hope is founded on God, who gives us resurrection power, holding out the power of new life, new beginnings in every situation. Another of the rules on which God has founded creation is the resurrection principle. All of creation is shot through with this power. Trees that look dead burst into leaf. Bulbs long dormant burst into flower. Butterflies emerge. Baby lambs, fluffy ducklings. New life floods all creation. And in our lives too. When bad things happen, we cannot undo them. We cannot put the clock back. But God, who is the source of all love and joy, will help us turn those bad things into wonderments of new life. New life that can flow from us into the lives of those around us. So where is God in our suffering? Right here, at our side, filling us with hope, urging us on to resurrection, urging us on to finding and living the new life that is always possible, no matter how great our grief or deep our suffering. And as we share that new life and live the love of God, so his kingdom comes in our midst. Thanks be to God. Amen.